there, everybody. You are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. This is episode number 296. Holy cow. In four episodes, that means it's episode 300. But first, so much business to get to. As always, you can get in touch with us by dropping us a line. Send an email on over to ken@thisshowisogay.com. Stroll on over to thisshowisogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. You can follow us on Twitter. The handle is This Show Is So Gay. And of course, go to the Facebook, type in This Show Is So Gay, like us, because we sure as heck like you. So much fun to get to on this week's episode. We must get started with our guest. Mark Bessinger is an award-winning screenwriter, director, and producer. He wrote and directed Bite Marks, which made the rounds at just so many film festivals. He wrote and directed Rhapsody with Nick Arnzen, who I love so much. He wrote and directed the short film Candy. His new movie is called The Last Straight Man. It is being released on DVD this week, and holy cow, is it getting great reviews. Mark, welcome back to This Show Is So Gay.
Thanks, Ken. Thanks for having me. It's good to be back.
Well, you say it's good to be back, but apparently you needed 4 years until you came back on the show. Is it me? Was it me? Tell me.
Kind of. I was waiting for an invitation.
It could be that. It could be that. I don't know. Well, we have so much to chat about, sir. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
All right, well, let's start with you as we start with all of our filmmakers. Let's take a step back, Mark. Tell our listening audience why the medium of film to get your voice out there.
It's interesting. It's just a medium that I've always found myself gravitated to. I just love the idea of using pictures and story and characters and visual techniques to tell a story and to get any messages, subtle or not so subtle, across that I want to, you know, relate to people.
Nice. What was the first ever Mark Bessinger experimentation with film? What was the first time you really said, okay, let me get a go of this?
Wow. Well, you know, it's when I was a young lad, and I was snooping through our hall closet, and I came across my mother's old, she had an old 8mm film camera.
Nice.
And it just looked like a lot of fun. And I asked her, so she went out and bought me a roll of film. And I started just like shooting, you know, making little movies with the neighborhood kids and my cousins and stuff like that. And it just kind of turned into a thing, you know. And then so by the time I graduated high school and I was looking around for something, you know, what did I want to do with my life? Film was one of the things that was in the loop, and I wasn't sure that I could, you know, if it was really something I could make a living at. So I kind of pursued other areas, but film just kept calling me back. So I kept making little short films and things just for fun. But it wasn't until I decided to go to film school at Columbia College, Chicago, and I decided to jump into it, you know, and see if I could make a go of it. So I did a couple little short films there, but that's where I did my first feature film, which was a horror action martial arts picture called Ninja Zombie.
Yes.
Which is finally going to get looks like it might be getting a release next year. That was something we just kind of made for fun and didn't really push it too hard, but there's been some interest in it lately, and so it looks like it might actually come out next year.
Where can we get our hands on some of those old 8mm Mark Bessinger early films? Is there an estate sale coming up? Where can we watch them?
Probably not in the near future.
Okay.
I think they're all packed away in a box in my garage someplace, and that is a territory that which not even I venture to tread out upon. So the only ones enjoying them right now are probably the mice and the Black Widow spiders.
Nice, nice. That's like the setup to a horror movie right there, which we should say, we talked about this years ago. You, sir, not that you don't have all of these different styles, but you do have a particular appreciation, maybe even a penchant, for the horror genre, do you not?
I do. I love horror films. I mean, they're probably my favorite, all-time favorite genre. Ever since I was 6 years old, I've just been totally enthralled by the horror film genre.
Now, I'm not saying that this is a therapy appointment for you, Mark, but what would you say that's about?
I don't know. I've often wondered that. It's just, I have a feeling that to some degree it ties into the homosexual experience when you look at monsters as the outsider in society.
Nice.
And how, some of them, their behavior is just them lashing back, because they can't be accepted, or, you know, the tale of, if you go back and watch the 1931 Frankenstein, by James Whale, who was openly gay or at the time, it's pretty obvious. You can just see like gay themes all over that movie. And I think that could be that could be part of why I find them so much fun. From my point of view, now a straight person might have a different answer, but for me, I kind of look at it as the outsider in society thing.
All right. I don't particularly love the horror mark. I actually get scared.
Well, that's okay too.
Okay.
What kind of horror movie would it be if it didn't scare you?
All right. You see, you go after that. I'm like, no, I just couldn't. I love it.
I've seen so many of them now. Very few of them scare me anymore because there are just so many different ways you can try to set up a scare in a film. And, you know, they usually telegraph themselves. So I see them coming. So, but I liked watching them with people, and I like to watch the other people jump. That gives me quite the giggle.
You say that you've seen a few. For those who are friends with you on Facebook, you are treated to, those of us who watch your feed, you are treated to some of just the most obscure horror films that you have seen all of them. I mean, you really have seen some random horror films. I had no idea there were so many out there.
Well, you know, as digital video cameras become more affordable and editing software becomes more affordable, and, you know, it just seems like there are more and more people just picking up these pieces of equipment and saying, hey, I can make a horror movie, and then they go out and make it. So it's the gates have opened. There's a flood coming out, but there are all kinds of movies out there that are being made just constantly. Unfortunately, most of them aren't very good, but that's what I like about watching all these movies is that, you know, yes, 75% of them might be garbage, but every so often you're going to come across one that just, really shines out, and you go, hey, that's really good, you know. And you might otherwise miss it if you just kind of look for only the ones that play theaters.
And there are some that are just so garbage that you have to watch them, right? Give us one that's just like, because I know that you've seen some that are just so bad that we have to watch them.
Oh, yeah, there's plenty of those. I mean, one of them is a movie I saw when I was a youngster, and but I watch it all the time because it's just so much fun. And it's called Dracula versus Frankenstein, directed by Al Adamson, who was kind of a schlock filmmaker, but there's just something that you know, it's like someone took one of my Super 8 films and made a feature film out of it. You know, it's just the acting's bad, it's shot badly, but there's just something really fun about it. So yeah, I mean, there are those kind of movies too. And I have a few friends, and between the three or four of us, we have bad movie nights at our houses every so often. We all invite a group of people to come over. We watch bad movies and make fun of them and have a good time doing it.
I love it. I love it. Don't ever invite me, but that's a fun concept. Yeah.
No worries about that.
Okay. What do you mean, no worries? You could invite me. I'm just saying I'm not going. Jeez, you made that one pretty clear. Well, let's talk about LGBT themes in some of these films. It strikes me, and especially because you are making some of these films and so you're filling a void, it strikes me that other than the metaphor, other than maybe the parable of gay people and their plight represented maybe in not as explicit ways in these movies, that there is kind of a dearth of LGBT content in the horror film genre. Is that fair to say?
Some of them definitely have subtext. Some of them have just like gay lesbian characters in the films, to make the cast and the characters more diverse. And I think that's a good thing.
Well, that brings us to you and some of your work. And as I said in your intro, so many different movies. Let's talk a bit about what you learned about yourself through some of these processes. Again, listeners, we're here with Mark Bessinger, award-winning screenwriter, director, producer. When you made the film Bite Marks, what did you learn about yourself as a filmmaker through that process?
I learned that... Well, I didn't learn anything. I'm actually a very shallow person. And, you know, any experience that might the might actually improve my life just slides off me like Teflon, you know. So actually what I had learned is from Bite Marks is that I hadn't done a horror themed thing for a long time, and getting back into it, it just reminded me of how much I really enjoyed doing it. I mean, you know, we had people running around screaming, we had blood, we had special makeup effects, you know, and just, it reminded me just how much I really enjoy working in that genre and that I need to do a lot more of it. And, working, you know, getting a good cast and crew together, you know, having a good time. It just reminded me of just what a joy that really is, and working in the world of monsters.
And I would imagine, because I've read so much of it online, it must have been really validating to get the kind of response that you got to that film, which was pretty praiseworthy.
Yeah, we did pretty well, but it was actually kind of, this is really interesting, or at least I think it is. It was actually kind of, the responses were kind of split. And we would find out, people seemed to either really love it or really hate it. And the ones who hated it, because when we did it, we thought we were being very smart, you know, and we decided we're going to do this gay comedy horror film, and it's going to appeal to two kinds of demographics. It's going to appeal to like the gay filmmaking population because we're going to have gay characters, blah, 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 blah. And then we thought, oh, we're also going to appeal to the horror community because they're going to like it and all this. Well, what it turned out to be was that the gay community accepted it pretty much. They seemed to really take to it. But the horror community, which you generally has, you know, a large part of them have like a kind of a 12-year-old heterosexual mentality, seemed to really not like it. And whenever I would read reviews from a non-gay horror site, from like a straight horror site, it was all, you know, the reviews almost always started out the same way, which was something along the lines of, don't think I don't like this movie because it's got gay stuff in it. That's not why I don't like it. But then the entire rest of the review would be all about the gay stuff.
Look at that.
And so it was just kind of an eye opener that, about that, you know. So I was happy that the audience, part of the audience found it, or the right audience found it. But I was really disappointed in that the horror audience kind of turned their back on it and didn't appreciate it. Not everybody. There were some people who really did like it. But I'd say the majority of the horror people who saw it didn't care for it. And, you know, always claiming that it wasn't because of the gay stuff, but then not being able to talk about anything other than the gay stuff.
Gotcha. Well, talk to me about the film Rhapsody, because that has a really interesting story to it in that when it was filmed and when it was released, those weren't the same week.
No, it wasn't. Rhapsody was my second feature film, and we shot it in Chicago in 1994. At the time, actor Nick Arnzen was my roommate in Chicago.
No
way! We were roommates back then. We'd known each other for about a year or so. I had written this script, and it was about a cabaret pianist who's trying to compose a rhapsody, but he's suffering from composer's block, and he can't finish it. And he meets this guy who is a construction worker, and they start dating, and they hit it off. But then after an eye-opening weekend in the country, the pianist realizes that the construction worker's got a secret, and once he finds out what that secret is, it changes their whole relationship, and he has to figure out how to deal with this new information. So at the time, I was thinking about, you know, how I was going to shoot this and casting, and I went to see a play that was being performed in Chicago called Party. And Party was the hot gay play to see in Chicago. It was about, I think, five or six gay friends who play a truth or dare type game. And the gimmick of the play was that by the end of the play, the entire cast is completely naked.
Okay.
So I went to see it. And when Nick Arnzen came out on stage, I was like, oh my God, that's exactly the kind of actor I'm envisioning for this character. And So I found out where he lived, and I sent him a copy of the script, and that started a dialogue. And when it came time to actually film it, I cast him, and we shot it. And then somewhere in the interim, he moved out of where he was, and I was looking for a roommate, and so he moved in with me, and we lived together for about a year.
Look at that. But then what happened?
Now, what happened was, after we made the film, it wasn't done. I got it as close to finishing as I could. It still needed some sound work, and it needed some color correcting and all that. But I didn't have any more money. So Nick and I decided to make the move to Los Angeles. And once I got out here, I started hitting up all the artistic arms of the studios. So I would go to, Fox Classics and Fox Searchlight and all those kind of people. And while everybody really liked it, no one wanted to give me the money to finish it. And so after that, the movie just kind of, we had one screening of it in Chicago, and then the movie just got lost. I figured that, I don't know what happened to it. It just disappeared, and I didn't know what happened. I thought it was gone. And then, fast forward to like last year, and I was going through some stuff in a storage unit, and bingo, there it was.
Wow.
So I took it out and looked at it, and I'm like, by this time I had my own editing system and everything like that. And I said, everything that I need to finish it, I can do myself right now. So we went back. And with another editor, who had the editor of Bite Marks, a guy called Mike Justice, we went back and we decided to tighten it up a little bit. We did a new edit on it, and going through it, we realized there were a lot of montages in it, a lot of them. So we decided to trim out some of the montages, and we tightened it up. We had the guy who scored Bite Marks, we had him do a new score for the music. We sent it back to my old film school, and they remastered all the footage, and then
wow,
they did a new sound mix for it and put it back. And I sent it out to a couple distributors to see if they'd be interested in it. But the thing is, it's like no one wants an old movie, even if it's never been seen before. They don't want to. If it's older than like a couple of years, they're just not interested, unless it's a classic. So what I decided to do was I was just going to put it up on Amazon.com as a streaming download purchase, and that's where you can get it if you want it. You can just go to Amazon.com and do a search on it. And you can download it, you can stream it, or if you want it on Blu-ray, I've got it. I'm selling it myself on eBay, so it can be seen now. It's after all this time, it's finally out there.
Talk to me about the differences in making an LGBT movie 20 years ago. The content that's in there and what you see now. What still resonates for you?
Well, I think back then there was a lot more. That movie has a lot more innocence to it. Although I think a lot of the same themes that are in Rhapsody, you can find in The Last Straight Man. I had a friend who watched both films and then said to me, "You just remade your own movie." And I said, "That's great." I said, "That's fine with me." But it's basically, there are a lot of similar themes. That of a straight man who's questioning his sexuality. That of a gay man who's in love with someone who he's not entirely sure he should be. The search for being with your true love, your the right partner. It's all about that search and that quest, and that's pretty predominant in both films.
Nice. Well, that brings us to your latest project, The Last Straight Man, which, as I said, is being released on DVD this week. Give everyone the premise of The Last Straight Man.
The Last Straight Man is a lighthearted drama about two men, Lewis, who is gay, but in the closet at the beginning of it, and he's throwing a bachelor party for his straight best friend, Cooper. Now, at the end of the party, both men are drunk, and they decide to play this game called Three Questions, where they can each ask the other person three questions about anything, and the other person has to tell the truth. Well, over the course of the game, Lewis comes out to Cooper as bisexual, and the two men end up going to bed together. Now, the next morning, instead of being regretful, Cooper admits that he actually enjoyed it, but he doesn't think he can do it again because he's getting married that day.
Right.
But we find out that the two men decide to meet in the same hotel suite on the same night every year to catch up with with each other on their lives and to further explore their sexuality. So the rest of the movie shows four more nights out of this relationship, and we get to see how their relationship changes with each other, how, you know, where they are in their lives, and, you know, how their friendship evolves.
Now, in my head, you did this Richard Linklater style and just did, you know, filmed a little bit every year for, you know, 14 years.
No, we shot the whole thing in Palm Springs, California in 8 days.
Okay.
And what we did was to help pass, make it look like a passage of time. I had both men, Mark Cirillo and Scott Sell, start growing their hair out and start growing beard. And then we just basically shot the scenes of the film in reverse.
Gotcha.
And then after, every time it was time to be another night, we would have them trim the beard, cut the hair, and then we would shoot the next scene, which would appear earlier in the film. So, to give the illusion that the time's passing and that they're changing their looks.
Love it. I love it. Well, as I mentioned, some great feedback already, and there's going to be so much more as people get to view it more as it is released. Over on Entertainment Focus, this is what they said on that website. Writer-director Mark Bessinger creates a scenario that at first seems unlikely but progresses into something believable that feels realistic. With strong performances, a tight script, and impressive direction, The Last Straight Man is one of those rare nuggets you find once in a while. Talk to me about that phrase, impressive direction. What does that mean to you? What do you feel like you did impressively with this piece of work?
Isn't that a great review? I think I'm going to have that tattooed on my back.
Yeah, I would. I would.
Impressive direction? I don't know. I think a large part of direction is getting the right cast. And I certainly did that with Mark Cirillo and Scott Sell. Now, Scott Sell, who plays Cooper, the straight guy, is the first one that I cast in the film. And he was living in Detroit, Michigan at the time, and he actually auditioned by sending me videos of him doing the lines. And I liked what he did, so I cast him in that part. And then for the other role, I had actually had another actor cast. He came to auditions. He was great. I cast him. But a month before we began filming, he had a family crisis, and he had to back out.
Okay.
Well, that threw everything into a tailspin, and we started grabbing at actors, looking at people, and just kept getting rejections. And then finally, one of the producers, Benjamin Lutz, who played the trucker in Bite Mark, Benjamin knew this actor that he had worked with, because he had done a film, I think, the year before called The Men Next Door from Guest House Films, and he says, there's this guy called Mark Cirillo, and I know he can handle the part. He's a very good actor. Plus, he does full frontal nudity in Men Next Door, so I know he's not going to have a problem with the nudity. So he brought Mark over. I auditioned him. He did a really good job, and we ended up casting him. And then when we started rehearsals, he and Scott just worked so well together. You know, I brought Scott out about a week and a half before we were going to start shooting, just for like an intensive rehearsal. We rehearsed every single day. And then at night, I would send Scott and Mark out to do things together so they could get used to each other, you know, and as people. And I think that really helped make the relationship believable. But it's stuff like that, you know, as director. I also knew that for this to work, that they had to become friends in real life. And the best way to do that is to get to know each other really well. So we would begin every rehearsal by playing the three questions game for real. So Mark would ask Scott three questions, and then Scott would return the favor. And the first rehearsal, we just would do very superficial stuff, you know, questions about superficial matters. Where are you from? Where'd you go to school? That kind of stuff. And then every day we would get a little more personal. And so by the time we were done with rehearsing, they knew each other pretty well. They had a pretty good, you know, understanding of who each other they were. And so when we went in to start shooting, you know, they were friends. They were actually very good friends, and it came across on screen. So, I would all fold that and file it away under impressive directing.
I love it. That's great. Oh, that's so great. Well, we've had so many filmmakers on the show over the years, Mark, and I will ask you that question that just keeps coming up with all of them. Talk to me about making LGBT content there in the film industry. You know, we've had filmmakers who have articulated the struggle. Others said, no, not so much. It's pretty easy to do. From your vantage point, talk to me about putting LGBT content out there and the receptivity to that.
Well, there are a few challenges to it. I mean, with Last Straight Man and my new project, which I'm sure we'll talk about later, we had you never know who you're dealing with and where the walls are going to hit you. It's like playing Plinko and you're the ball and you're trying to get to the end of it. And you keep hitting these little walls and trying to roll and find the next opening. We would have auditions and we would get a hundred actors who would want to come in and audition. But then the first thing is and you send them the script and then they see that it's gay. And even though, on those sites they go to, they should know beforehand that it's gay. And then they don't show up and they don't call you to tell you they're not coming because then they don't want to just deal with you. So they just don't show up. So on both these productions, that was a big problem. We just had actors who would make an appointment and then not show up. And then so you're sitting there with long spaces of time and with just twiddling your thumbs and wondering where everybody is. And then with Last Straight Man, it wasn't so much of a problem. We had people show up. They knew what was going on. They were okay with it. There were a few that showed up. One guy showed up and when he heard that there was nudity in it, he was actually angry. He thought he'd been tricked into this. And we were no, it's, go back and look on the website where the audition notice is. It says very clearly right there. But the odd thing is we had a hard time getting a crew together to shoot this because there were just a lot of gaffers and assistant camera people who just didn't want to work on a gay production. And that really threw me for a loop because I'm like, all you got to do is stand there and set the lights. You don't have to. We're not asking you to kiss another kiss another man. All you got to do is want you to, pull focus. But it took a while. We finally found some people, and it was a small crew, which made it even more difficult. But that really kind of threw me for a loop. And then just finding people because here in Los Angeles, it's not like in other parts of the country where people are like, oh my gosh, I get to be in a movie or I want to do this part. This is going to be a great role for me. In Los Angeles, everyone in the industry, it's all about their career. And I don't fault them for that. But it's like, if I do this gay movie, how is that going to affect my getting another movie?
Right.
That's not a gay movie. So everybody is factoring that into their decision. And it's kind of a pain. Because I'm like, this is a really good role. You should be wanting to do it. But I understand. Well, then comes the task of raising financing. So with Last Straight Man, we had gone to a distributor and said, it was a distributor of gay product. And we were like, would you be interested in financing this movie? And they were like, maybe. So they did some cursory testings of foreign markets and stuff like that, but nothing ever came of it. So we just went around, started talking to friends and people who we thought might be interested and people with money and all that. And the odd thing was that, we were really having a hard time, even with openly gay people with lots of money would not want to invest in it, even though they liked the project. But they wouldn't want to invest in it because they would say, well, I just can't put money into a gay movie because my family and my friends would disapprove if I did.
Wow.
And that always kind of made me scratch my head. So, you know, luckily we finally came across a production company that liked the script and believed in it and gave us the money to make the film. Because we were just getting nowhere. We did an Indiegogo campaign on it, which was a disaster. We didn't raise hardly anything on that. So yeah, I mean, there are a lot of problems with it. Now, when you get the film done, if it's a film with gay content and it's an independent film, you have some limited options about distribution. You can always try distributing it yourself, but that's a full-time job. And if you don't have the time to do it, well, you're not going to succeed with it.
Right.
And there's only a handful of distributors, small distributors out there who, specifically are geared toward gay and lesbian content. So it's really a maze that you have to walk through. And, a lot of people don't do it, especially if you want to turn out a product that's got a lot of quality to it. Anybody can pick up a camera or their cell phone and make a film, but, my God, it better be good if you want to try to get someplace with it.
Right, right. Well, this new one coming out, pretty darn good, The Last Straight Man. What's coming up for you next, sir?
I'm currently in production on a new project. It's called Confessions, and it's an anthology film of 16 different monologues that are performed by gay male characters, and each one is telling us, over the course of his monologue, he's telling us a secret about himself or something that happened in his past. And each one's a different tone. There's one that's a horror film. There's one that's a comedy. There's one that's a romance. There's one that's a concert performance. And they're all different tones and flavors. Some are dark. Some are light. Some are funny. And we'll put them together, and it'll be 16 different stories by 16 different very good actors.
That's awesome. I love that. When is that coming out? I'm ready.
It'll probably be later this year. We're still in production. We have three more. We've shot 13 of the 16 monologues. We have three more to go, which we'll have those in the can by the end of March. I'm hoping that the film will be completely edited and everything by mid-May. And then we'll start submitting it to film festivals, and I'm sure we'll talk to distributors, and maybe by the end of this year, we'll get it out.
Sounds good. Sounds good.
That's going to be a fun movie. That's going to be a fun movie. It's going to have, we've got in it, we've got Peter Stickles from The Lair. We've got Vincent Cusimano from George, A Zombie Intervention. We've got singer Tom Goss.
We love Tom Goss.
Yeah, Tom Goss is going to do one. And he wrote a song specifically for the film, and he's going to perform it as his segment. And there's just all kinds of people. We've got Dylan Vox from all those movies he's done. It's just going to be a lot of fun. There's going to be like a lot of people in it and lots of, familiar faces and lots of really good performances.
So sounds
I think
great.
People are going to kind of like it. It's something a little different, but I think it's going to be worthwhile watching.
We love different. Different is good. Different is good. I will tell you, listening audience, Mark Bessinger, award-winning screenwriter, director, producer, did determine this week's music, which we've not let a guest do in a while, so it's super fun. So I'm just going to make you explain.
Yay.
I love it. We're going to make you explain one of these songs. This is the part of the show where you are going to do a little self-analysis based on your song selections, because this just cracks me up.
Okay.
I love, after 296 episodes, when someone requests a song that we've not gone anywhere near. So tell our listening audience what Annette Funicello's The Monkey's Uncle says about Mark Bessinger. What an amazing choice.
Mark Bessinger just likes I have wide and varied taste in music, and there are times where I just like a song that for no other reason than it just be like light and bouncy and well sung and just a happy song, something you can just like kind of snap your fingers to while you're driving, or just like, you know, bounce down the street while you're walking. And I love Annette Funicello. I like her as a singer. And The Monkey's Uncle is just one of those songs. When she died, people were posting songs on that she had sung on Facebook. And a friend of mine posted The Monkey's Uncle, which I had forgotten about. I posted a song of her doing Pajama Party. And a friend of mine posted The Monkey's Uncle, and he said, listen to this song at your own peril, because it will get stuck in your head. And your Monkey's Uncle is just one of those songs. If I hear it once, it'll be stuck in my head for the next 3 or 4 days. It's just that bouncy and fun.
I want to remind our listening audience that if you have The Monkey's Uncle stuck in your head now after this interview, it was writer-director Mark Bessinger, not This Show Is So Gay host Ken Schneck. I want to put the blame where it should be.
I take full responsibility.
Okay. All right. Well, listen, coming out this week, The Last Straight Man, folks can stroll on over. It's got its own Facebook page, but you can also, and what you should be doing, folks, is strolling on over to tlavideo.com. You can type in The Last Straight Man, and you can order it right there. Because, let me tell you, sir, if I've learned one thing after doing this show for so long, is that there is a community out there that's starved for not only great material, but also for LGBT content. And you do both. You are not just putting out content just to put content out there, but as the reviews indicate, and from what I've seen myself, you are putting out content that people are really eating up, because it's quality stuff with great performances and impressive direction, and it's entertaining. So we so appreciate, on behalf of the community, Mark, that you are taking the time and colossal amounts of effort to put these movies out there that have our community represented in such entertaining ways.
Oh, thank you. It's very sweet of you.
Folks, again, The Last Straight Man, it's over on Facebook. There's a page there. And go order it over on tlavideo.com. Comes out this week. Mark, can we not let another 4 years go by before you come back?
Absolutely. You know what? Just call me. Call me whenever a guest drops out. I'm never doing anything, you know. I'll like, yeah, sure, what the hell. You know, I'll do it. You know, in fact, I can even pretend to be other people if they get that desperate, too. You know, I can, you know, I'll be some, like, gay guy who's hiding in an airport terminal because he, you know, doesn't have a place to live or something. Yeah, that's actually not a bad story.
Mark Bessinger, award-winning screenwriter, director, producer, and backup This Show Is So Gay guest. Mark, what an absolute pleasure having you back on the show. Thank you so much.
You're absolutely welcome.
Folks, and we are back. Well, we have some time left on this week's episode to get you all the latest LGBT news out there. Let me just put this out there. I try to balance out some of the depressing anti-gay news with victories, and it's been pretty great in the past couple of years of just saying, oh, hey, marriage equality here and great bill passed here. This was not one of my more successful weeks. So I'm sorry. I feel like the negative stories outweigh the positive, but that's just kind of what was going on this week. So we start with Arkansas. This past Monday was the deadline for Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson to veto this bill called SB 202, which is an anti-discrimination bill that seeks to prevent cities and counties from protecting the civil rights of gay people. No joke, this is a proactive piece of legislation to bar cities and counties from enacting legislation that would protect gay people. Well, the bill passed the legislature about a week and a half, 2 weeks ago, and Governor Hutchinson said he would allow it to become law. Even though pressure had been mounting for him to change his mind, it will now go into law because Governor Asa Hutchinson has not vetoed it. Last week, the Arkansas chapter of the Human Rights Campaign released a statement condemning the bill. The chapter director, Kendra Johnson, said this, quote, "Discrimination is not an Arkansas value, and the governor should take swift, immediate action to veto SB 202, end quote. All these other groups joined in the fight to try to get him to veto it, but ultimately he did not veto it. There was a joint press statement from a lot of different groups. They said this quote, it's a great quote, "There is nothing but discriminatory intent here, and no valid public interest can possibly be served by allowing private businesses to discriminate based on sexual orientation, gender identity, or other characteristics that might be covered by local ordinances." And not only were all of these groups like the American Civil Liberties Union and Lambda Legal and the National Center for Lesbian Rights, not only were all these groups getting together to make a statement, but Cher made a statement. And if you're thinking, oh, is that someone who works in an organization, surely you're not talking about legend Cher of the gay icon world, best singer ever. Okay, maybe not the best singer ever, but what an LGBT icon. No, Cher, of all people. She took to Twitter. She loves her tweeting, and she wrote this. She tweeted, "Why am I not surprised that Asa Hutchinson, governor of Arkansas, is hanging LGBT community out to dry?" But not even that, not even the voice of Cher changed the governor's mind. He allowed it to come into law. There is a lot of questions of folks out there of like, hey, where are the folks that are really standing up against this on a national scale, including Bill and Hillary Clinton, you know, from Arkansas. But unfortunately, nope, it has not been vetoed. It will be written into law. So very depressing there in Arkansas. In kind of a more humorous, though still negative story, you gotta love this one. Religious right activists have long campaigned against the Girl Scouts of the USA, and pastors Kevin Swanson and Dave Bwenner of Generations Radio have now joined in by urging listeners not to purchase Girl Scout cookies. This does have an LGBT angle, because this is what Pastor Kevin Swanson said. He said, quote, "Please, I beg of you, do not buy Girl Scout cookies." He said, "If you do, you should, quote, take a big, fat, black magic marker and start marking out all of the references to the Girl Scouts of America on all the boxes, because they are a wicked organization that promotes lesbianism." What? Apparently, the Girl Scouts of America promoting lesbianism. This was his actual quote. "The individualism of feminism has been devastating to this country. I say you ought to say no to the Girl Scout cookies, too. I don't want to support lesbianism. I don't want to support Planned Parenthood. And I don't want to support abortion. And if that be the case, I'm not buying Girl Scout cookies." So there you go. If you get your Thin Mints, you are apparently supporting lesbianism. Who knew? I did not know that. So I actually, you know, may kind of want to buy more. I want to buy more. More fun quotes, more crazy quotes, more anti-gay crazy quotes coming out of Ireland. An Irish family campaigning group has launched a series of extraordinary attacks against same-sex couples, including claims that same-sex couples die younger, are more prone to cancer, and are more likely to abuse and injure children. The Alliance for the Defense of the Family and Marriage, an initiative based in Ireland which claims to, quote, protect and defend the traditional family, end quote, they've been distributing leaflets to spread their beliefs this week. Witnesses say that they have been handed outside of churches and at rugby matches, among other venues. A journalist for the Irish website Her was handed one of the pamphlets outside a Divine Mercy event in Dublin. It comes in the run-up. This is all what's going on in Ireland right now. There's an Irish Republic's referendum on same-sex marriage. It's going to take place on May 22nd. So there's this whole pamphleting campaign called Why Should I Vote Against Same-Sex Marriage? And they have listed reasons why readers should vote against the marriage equality referendum. And so they say that same-sex marriage is, quote, a confidence trick. So like a con, which tends to be very short-lived and promiscuous, and that frequently same-sex pairs don't even live together. And apparently they get cancer at higher rates and they die younger, and this is what people are coming up with. Kind of, I know this is radio, or maybe you're listening via podcast, but you can kind of smell the desperation, can't you? You can smell the desperation. That's when the rhetoric gets amped up, is when they feel like there's a real fight in front of them. And so that's what's going on in Ireland. So crazy. In Scotland, really close to Ireland, a gay couple, they're considering taking legal action after a luxury hotel on Loch Lomond allegedly refused to consider hosting their wedding because of their sexual orientation. John and Stephen Devaney from Glasgow said the owner of the Loch Lomond waterfront ushered them out after the couple said they were looking for a wedding venue. The resort didn't want to comment on this, but the couple said, quote, "She couldn't hide her disgust. She told me we can't allow people like you in here," and said gay marriage was against her beliefs. "I told her she was entitled to her beliefs, but gay marriage was now legal. She just said she was the owner so she could say and do as she liked. She then told us marriage should be between one man and one woman only, not two men like us or two women. The woman just ushered us out, and her wedding planner stood there utterly embarrassed and in disbelief." So they are considering legal action. That's what's going on in Scotland. So much happening. But this is the story that drove me more crazy than any of the other stories, which is pretty bad because, you know, these were some negative things that a lot of people were saying. In Texas, we're coming back to the U.S. We've left Ireland. We've left Scotland. We're coming back to the U.S., to Texas. They have not seceded. Texas, part of the 50-state union in which we all currently live, unless you're listening overseas, in which case, bienvenue, hi, how are you? Thank you for listening. But in Texas, here in the U.S., Texas lawmakers joined conservative leaders at the Capitol this week to slice cake together, which is celebratory. That seems great, right? No, it was a symbolic wedding cake. They were celebrating, and there are pictures of this, the 10th anniversary celebration of the constitutional amendment that defined Texas marriages as the union of one man and one woman. A Facebook post by conservative group Texas Values announced the celebration. It drew hundreds and hundreds of comments. The comments keep going. You have to see this picture. It's everywhere. So some of the comments said, quote, "My home state's religious bigotry and God-approved hatred for their fellow man deeply saddens me." Yeah, that about sounds right. But then, because I read through the comments, there were a lot of people saying, yes, this is great. Let's celebrate this. So they are in session right now in the Texas legislature, and they gathered together for a photo op to cut a piece of cake, to cut a symbolic wedding cake to celebrate the 10th anniversary of the constitutional amendment that defined Texas marriages as the union of one man and one woman. It's crazy. It's crazy. Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick actually spoke at this event. He called on Christians to rally in the battle for exclusively traditional marriages in Texas. He said this, quote, "It's a battle, but we will be victorious because with God, who can be against us? We know how it all ends." Unbelievable. And they're so smiley. And they're so white. I think there might be a person of color in the background. I'm not really sure. He's kind of obscured. These are white men and two white women dressed in red. And they're so smiley, and they're cutting the cake, and they are celebrating, yes, this is a victory for us. Very depressing. Very depressing. Can we get some happy stories in there? There are some happy stories out there. I love this one. For our tech listeners, we love our tech listeners. Same-sex families will now soon have a place on the emoji keyboard. On Monday, it was revealed that a new beta version of the operating system 8.3 will include an array of diverse emojis, including characters with different skin colors as well as different family makeups. Same-sex parents are included in the publicly unreleased version of the wildly popular emoticon board. There are families with two moms and families with two dads. An Apple spokeswoman told PC Magazine that Apple supports and cares deeply about diversity, and they are working with the Unicode Consortium to update the standard so that it better represents the diversity for all of us. I love this. So there are going to be all of these new emojis that will be reflective of our community. See, there is good news out there, people. It's not just crazy people saying horrible things. There's actually progress in certain areas, too. And more progress, we reported a few weeks ago that the State Department was going to name their first ever LGBT rights envoy, and they did. Randy Berry, this past week, was named the nation's first special envoy for global LGBT rights. Secretary of State John Kerry made the announcement. John Kerry said this, quote, "He's a voice of clarity and conviction on human rights, and I'm confident that Randy's leadership as our new special envoy will significantly advance efforts underway to move towards a world free from violence and discrimination against LGBT persons." Look at that. Randy Berry this week named the first special envoy for global LGBT rights. Love that. Love it. Over on the conversion therapy ban front, again, there's only a couple places, New Jersey and California, that have made significant inroads in banning conversion therapy, but now Iowa might be added to the list. A subcommittee of the Iowa Senate approved a bill last week that would ban licensed therapists and mental health professionals from using conversion therapy in an attempt to change the sexual orientation of gay minors. State Senator Matt McCoy of Des Moines, who is openly gay, he said this, quote, "You will harm a person irreparably by doing this kind of work on them as a child, and this will impact their whole life. It'll impact how they can relate to others. It will impact their self-worth." The full Senate Human Services Committee is expected to vote on the bill in the next several weeks. And I would like to again remind you guys, there are only two states that ban conversion therapy. If you are one of those people who think that when we achieve marriage equality, which could potentially happen this summer with the Supreme Court, that we're good, we're not. We are not even remotely good. And some of our most vulnerable populations, which includes our LGBT youth, are still susceptible to being forced into conversion therapy, which really can harm them for the rest of their lives. It does no good. It does no good. Every piece of research out there says that conversion therapy does no good. So if you are in one of those other 48 states, get going on this. Write a letter to your senator. Write a letter to your representative. I know you guys, a lot of you are in the New England area and you think everything's great. Yes, there are many great things, but there is not one state in New England right now. Even though all of those states allow marriage equality, every single one of those states also allows conversion therapy. There is no ban. So do something. Do something. In Alabama, Alabama Governor Robert Bentley said at the end of last week that he will not resist a federal ruling that struck down the state's marriage equality ban. The Alabama State Supreme Court Chief Justice Roy Moore, we've been talking about him, he had earlier told probate judges in Alabama not to issue marriage licenses in spite of the ruling. But Alabama Governor Robert Bentley said, quote, "We are a nation under laws. We may not always agree with them, but we obey them." Thank you. Thank you, Alabama Governor Robert Bentley. I love that. Hey, let's go again abroad. The Finnish president, Sauli Niinisto, and I'm sure there's no way I said that correctly, he signed a bill last week that will allow same-sex couples in Finland to marry. In Finland! The legislation will take effect in 2017. It will make Finland the last Scandinavian country to legalize marriage equality. More than 167,000 Finnish citizens signed a petition to demand that lawmakers take up the issue, over three times the minimum requirement for parliamentary review. The bill is the first such publicly backed proposal to become law. Let's all go to Finland. That's pretty darn exciting. I love it. Back to the U.S. Oh, gosh, again. So, we had Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And one of the most common misconceptions about Don't Ask, Don't Tell is that it helped everyone in the LGBT community. No, it didn't, everyone. Yes, it allowed lesbian, gay, and bisexual men and women to serve openly, but it did not apply to the T, to the transgender population. Well, now Defense Secretary Ashton Carter, he said at the end of last week, he said that he is open to ending the military's ban on openly transgender service members. He said this, quote, "I don't think anything but their suitability for service should preclude them." Ashley Broadway Mack, the president of the American Military Partner Association, said, quote, "While we applaud Secretary Carter for being open-minded on this issue, we urge him to take action that will lead to ending this ban that continues to harm our transgender service members and their families." There was a poll this week that asked all the readers, will Defense Secretary Ashton Carter reverse the military's ban on openly transgender service members? The choices were yes, no, or I'm not sure, too soon to tell. And 61.7% of the respondents said, yes, I think Defense Secretary Ashton Carter will reverse the military's ban on openly transgender service members. 29.3% said, I'm not sure, it's too soon to tell. And 9% said no. I will say, let me just go back to Arkansas for a second, because there was one happy story out of Arkansas. An Arkansas town just passed an ordinance that bans discrimination against city employees on the basis of both sexual orientation and gender identity. But that policy, so there's a town in Arkansas, Conway, Arkansas. They voted 6-2 in favor of adding workplace protections for LGBT city employees. But if that statewide anti-gay bill becomes law, which it looks like it's going to, then that policy would be moot. That's how crazy it is. There are actually communities in Arkansas. We do not want to sit here on This Show Is So Gay and characterize all of Arkansas as being anti-gay, because that is not the case whatsoever. Not the case whatsoever. But these efforts to come up with pro-gay ordinances will just be completely struck down by Governor Asa Hutchinson and all the politicians who feel the best use of their time is not spent on education. It is not spent on the economy. It's not spent on talking about race. It is spent on taking away rights. Proactively taking away rights so that the city council in Conway, Arkansas, who voted 6-2 in favor of adding these protections, it would be moot. It would take that away. How crazy is that? How crazy is that? And, you know, what's crazier is it's not the only state that that's happening. We heard Justin Chenette, Representative Chenette in Maine, say that that's something they're taking on in Maine. In North Carolina right now, the North Carolina Senate approved a bill last week that would allow state and county officials to refuse to issue marriage licenses or perform same-sex weddings on the basis of, quote, and here it is, sincerely held religious objections. Senate Bill 2, which means this is the second piece of legislation they are working on during this session. Senate Bill 2 would allow magistrates and assistant and deputy registers of deeds to, quote, recuse themselves from performing marriage ceremonies due to any sincerely held religious objections. These are government officials who are paid through our tax dollars to carry out the laws, but we want to give them an out to say, no, 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 if it conflicts with their religion. Well, you know what? It wasn't that long ago, and I hate going here, but I'm going there in 2 seconds. It wasn't that long ago that people were claiming religion as a basis for segregation. And here we are in North Carolina rewriting the laws to say, hey, no, 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 no. Even though it would be the law to allow these unions to take place, to allow these marriages to happen, we want to give them an out in case they disagree with it, and we're going to use the umbrella of religion. So unbelievably infuriating. So unbelievably infuriating. Last one, we're going to end on a happy note. It's so great. If you haven't seen this, you got to go read the whole thing. A 9-year-old girl has penned a letter to Congress demanding nationwide marriage equality. BuzzFeed reported that Maggie, an elementary school student from Texas, has submitted a strongly worded and reasonable request to the legislative branch of the U.S. government to change laws that discriminate against gays and lesbians. She said this, quote, "Dear Congress," this is a 9-year-old, "Dear Congress, would you like it if someone wouldn't let you get married to a person you loved of your own gender? No. So why are you not letting people do that? That needs to change, and it needs to change now. Would you rather me send letters all year, or you listen the first time? Your choice." And she concluded, "Sincerely, Maggie." I love it. Maggie's father submitted the letter to the online news outlet because he was impressed by the passion and beyond her years moral clarity of his daughter, who is in the third grade. Her father said, quote, "What is surprising to us is the forceful language she chose. She clearly has very strong views about right and wrong, fairness and injustice, and, as she has learned by age 9, sometimes assertive actions are what is needed. She also wrote in a paper for school that she wanted to advocate for LGBT rights, so her decision to write a letter concerning LGBT rights is quite pleasing, but not out of the ordinary for her." We love this. If this does not give you hope, we want you to have hope here at the end of this episode when we covered all these states proactively trying to take rights away. Well, there's a 9-year-old in Texas who, in spite of her legislators cutting a cake celebrating the lack of marriage equality, there's a 9-year-old in Texas who is using her voice to make a difference. And that's what we urge you guys to do. You know you got to get out there and do it. Use your voice the way you know how to use it to make a difference for your LGBT and ally brothers and sisters. And I urge you guys, while you're out there using a voice, whether you are making a movie or penning a letter or just having a conversation, get out there and do it. And remember, why be gay when you can be so gay?